All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the American Vindicta Show. Today I have with us one of my guest instructors for the Active Shooter Awareness and Reaction Course, Mr. Steve Reyes. I'm going to let Steve introduce himself and his career and where that's taken him in life. And you can hear his bona fides as this man tells you a very extensive career. And as to why, I'm so happy that we have warrior men of God like Steve on our side, and you'll find out just as well that we should all be very thankful to have men like Steve on our side, and the things that we can learn from Steve that he's willing to teach us and show us to help us be not just better with the combatives, but also better as Christians, better as people for those times when you may get stuck in a hairy situation. You may need to rely upon this or even to save somebody. So Steve, man, thanks so much for being on. This has been a time in making for you and I. And why don't you introduce yourself to everybody?
All right, thanks. It's good to be here with you, Doug. And I've looked forward to this as well. We've talked about it for a while, and so I'm glad it's finally happening. And I appreciate the intro, and it's the feeling is mutual. I have the utmost respect for you and individuals with the talent, you know, the rare individuals that have the talent that you have. And as I've listened to your show, you know, some of your guests who you all have the ability to, you know, speak, articulate very clearly difficult, complex issues, I'm getting a lot out of it. So I'm kind of, you know, honored to be on your show. I am retired Army. I retired in July of 2014. That was after 18 years of military service. And I was medically retired. 15 years in special forces. One of the very unusual things about me was the fact that I didn't go into the military till I was 35 years old. So that made me an oddball in that respect. I was 35, had a wife and three kids, had a master's degree, but the most that you could do at that age, the most the military would give you was E4. So enlisting as an E4, and very quickly I realized that I would want kind of a greater challenge than what I initially enlisted for, which was just some medical MOS, combat medic, but really research assistant. It was doing some research, and I found out real quickly that it's not really what I thought it would be, and I wanted something more challenging. So I went in 1996, and early in 1997, I went to Special Forces selection, and was, by the grace of God, I was selected. And then that was 1997. In 1998, I started the Special Forces Qualification Course. And 2.5 years later, in July of 2001, I graduated all the training as a Special Forces 18 Delta, which is a specialization in medicine. And as we all know, in September of 2001, just a few months after I got to 5th Special Forces Group at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, 9/11 happens, and I just happened to have gotten to 5th Group At the right time, they happened to put me on a scuba team, and the first three teams that they sent into Afghanistan were scuba teams. And so I had a very rare opportunity and privilege to be part of a that the operation that actually is depicted in the movie 12 Strong. 12 Strong depicts one of those three teams. There were actually three teams that went into country at basically the same time. So that's kind of my claim to fame, is being on one of those three teams.
How was that first deployment like? Whenever you first when you first touched ground, I mean, after the magnitude of the 9/11 terror attack, did you feel anything animus wise towards the people in Afghanistan? Because I know when we went to Iraq, there was a lot of animosity for us towards the Iraqis. But how did you feel first time, boots on the ground? Where you just were, what were your emotions like? What were you thinking?
Well, it was a very unusual, exceptional experience, and that was made very clear to all of us, you know, the operation, the ODA members, Operational Detachment Alpha members of those three teams. It was very obvious that we were being a part of something extremely unusual, historic, and dangerous. They didn't hesitate to. We went into isolation very quickly after 9/11, went into isolation at Fort Campbell, and they were not shy about the briefs, you know, briefing us that of all the dangers, and that, you know, basically it was kind of like that movie, the little kid movie Madagascar, where it was like, we don't expect the private to make it. You know, the private will probably not make it through this mission. And and so they made it really clear that we were going into something that was very unusual and unknown, and we might not all, and we likely will not all return. And that certainly was the case. But thank God everybody on my team returned. But it was an unusual, I guess the thing that really stands out to me about that deployment is that when we were infilling, and it was, you know, blacked out clandestine infill, you know, to link up with a CIA agent who was already on the ground, and he'd take us to a safe house. And, you know, as we're going into that environment, and here I am brand spanking new in the military. I'm not some 18, 19 year old kid. At this point, I'm like maybe a 38, at this point, probably 38 or 39 years old, grown man, totally aware of the bizarre circumstances that I am facing. And yet the only thing on my brain at that time was the training, the fact that this infill felt just like a lot of the training that we had participated in the Special Forces qualification course. It made me realize the value of real world, realistic training, which is, you know, part of what you and I, you know, what I've gotten experience with you already, and what we intend to try to do together, and, you know, helping people who want to be prepared for the craziness that we're facing in this world.
And, you know, you speak of falling back on training, which is something that, you know, us more senior guys, we try to teach the younger guys, you will fall back on training when everything goes into madness. Remember your training. You know, so many times you've heard that, remember your training. I remember coming out of the School of Infantry and then going into my unit in 3-3, and they said, all right, now forget everything you just learned in School of Infantry. and now you're in the fleet. We're going to teach you a new way of warfare. Did you have a similar experience whenever you got to the group? Did they say, forget what you just learned, now we're going to teach you something new and hopping on a plane and going to Afghanistan? How was that?
I didn't have that experience. It was, I don't know, it, you know, it was very much what I experienced going again as a total newbie onto a special forces operational detachment. There was a tremendous amount of respect. There was really no distinction between, or very little distinction between the highest ranking individual and the lowest ranking individual on that operational detachment. It was simply understood that everybody was a professional, that everyone went through the same rigorous selection process and training to get to that point. And it was mutual respect. And one of the unique things, I mean, I may be one of the very few, you know, United States military personnel who deployed, and during that 4 to 5 month deployment that we were in Afghanistan, I never saw another U.S. military member my entire time in Afghanistan. It was my 9 teammates. I never saw, you know, we were just operating that remotely. So for us, it was very much just cooperate and graduate, you know, and in this case, graduation meant make it home alive. So,
well, I could tell through our experiences together that, you know, there's still a lot that you learn there that you naturally fall back on, even though you've been out of the loop for a little bit. You know, you still naturally fall back on that instinctual training that it really doesn't leave ever, I believe, once it's been instilled into you. Once you go through the indoctrination, like what you've been in, you really don't forget. It becomes muscle memory, even if it becomes a little bit of a rusted muscle memory. Here's what I'd like to know. Take your experiences from the military and apply it now as a civilian. Do your trained experiences and also your deployed experiences still correlate to your own personal safety and security and the way you look at the world? Obviously, America's much more dangerous now. But when the tide starts to become too much and America becomes very dangerous, which is the series of explanations we're going to get into, does your training from then still carry over?
Yes. Yeah, that one's pretty a definitive yes. I've kind of, even though I retired in 2014, I've stayed up until July of 2021. So just a couple years ago, not even just a year and a half ago, I was a civilian, but I was training soldiers. As you're aware, I was a SEER instructor. So I was still in that community, and it felt really good to stay in that community. And so I kind of had a smooth transition into civilian life. It was probably easier for me than most people. I mean, I had 5 combat deployments, very, very difficult. I look back on my military experience and my 5 deployments, and I have the utmost respect for everyone that I worked with. All of my observations of the conduct of every military person that I observed was acting honorably. That's simply what I saw. And I saw a lot, but I was very impressed that even these young young guys, young soldiers, airmen, Marines, whatever, they were all, by my observation, conducting themselves very honorably, very caringly for the host nation people. And so, but then again, you know, so I was older. And in fact, you know, I had been a civilian. I was 35 years old when I went in. So I'd been a civilian for a long time. And it was only a couple years later, you know, that here I find myself on my first deployment. So that was the real shocker. I was a country club tennis pro before I went into the military. And now I am in Afghanistan, you know, eating goat meat, you know, by somebody who was barefoot and filthy and flies covering the meat before they prepared it. And of course we all got dysentery, but, you know, so, but all of a sudden I'm going native in Afghanistan at 38 years old. And yet it really was kind of like the training. It was all about the training, because I'm, you know, my prior life was radically different than that. And so now, yes, now, it's been a fairly easy transition for me. But then I think faith in God, there's no question about it. Faith in God got me through my 18 years in the military. And it's my faith in God that has me bold to face the absurdity that we're facing these days, you know, of what's happening in our country. So
can you tell the audience what the standard living conditions were on that deployment? I mean, obviously, you know, you got dysentery, but how were the people, the Afghani people in the village that you were at, how was their living conditions compared to Americans?
Right. Yeah. Good question. And so to say third world is not adequate whatsoever. It was biblical times. I was observing a people who were still functioning as I understand people were functioning in biblical times. Hand tools, using animals as their means of conducting daily life, you know, preparing the soil, getting from point A to point B, just a very simple people who were really content with very little. And one thing, I mean, and there was very little. I was in a barren land. It was all brown, you know, virtually no vegetation. We were there in October, and, you know, some cold months, and there was snow while we were there. And it was as if we consumed every bit of wood, 10 U.S. military personnel were buying up all the wood that was in that area just to heat, you know, our mud living quarter. So we slept on the ground. We ate off a plastic mat where the food was served to us on the ground, on this plastic mat. And you know, a young man would come in and remove remove his footwear, whatever, his sandals, and just walk all over our plastic mat with his dirty feet and setting the food down for us. And so it was biblical times. That's the way I describe it.
Let me segue into something, because you say that biblical times. I mean, you're talking about times of very primitive means, you know, hand tools, using animals for mechanical devices still at that point, having to actually go and fetch your own water. How are they, were they boiling their water?
Well, being that I was the medic on the team, it was part of my responsibility to make sure that food preparation was being done in as healthy a way as possible. So, you know, we were, you know, I wasn't overseeing, wasn't able to oversee all the food, the food preparation. You kind of have to remember that this was the very beginning. And for the first month or so that we were in Afghanistan, it was as if there were no U.S. personnel in Afghanistan. And everybody was trying to figure out, you know, where are all these bombs? Who's guiding these bombs? You know, okay, yeah, we hear there's a few special forces teams. Where are they? And so we were living very clandestine. I do remember we had a safe house that we were living in, just a few mud structures surrounded by probably a 10-foot mud wall, and nobody knew who was behind there. None of the locals knew. They wanted to know. They were trying to kind of figure it out, but we had Afghani forces that were pulling perimeter security for us outside of that mud wall perimeter. And I do remember we were in there, and when we moved out of there to go to our operational locations, it was covered up in the back of vehicles. We'd get into the back of a, you know, old Russian vehicle or some dilapidated, you know, vehicle, and we're in the back of like a pickup truck, and we're covered up as we get moved, you know, to the point, that the place where we're going to be operating for that day. And so there was no freedom. We didn't want to be seen. And one time while we were in the safe house, there was a lot of commotion outside the mud wall, right outside our gate. There was a lot of commotion. And one of our Afghan personnel said, a young child has been hit by a car, because there would be convoys of Northern Alliance vehicles. The Northern Alliance, or, you know, was the host nation military force that we were supporting. And some convoy of vehicles had run over a little kid right outside our safe house. And so I said to our team sergeant, I said, can I go treat that? Can I treat this kid? And they were, you know, team sergeant was, nope, we can't, you know, no, nobody can know we're here. They, you know, they're looking for us, but we need to make it hard for them to find us. So I forget what took me in that direction, but yeah, it was, yeah, I don't.
You always have little things like that. There were numerous times on patrols where we would have family members come and, you know, show us their kids that were hurt, either by coalition forces or by Al Qaeda or the Ba'ath Party, or just, you know, the plain old Sunni Shia infighting that happened nonstop. Did y'all experience that with the infighting?
At least at that point, you know, I was also a part of what you were a part of, the initial invasion of Iraq. I was there in 2003, rolled in, you know, with Third ID, you know, towards Baghdad. And so that was an entirely radically different experience than what this Afghanistan, this first 2001 Afghanistan experience was. No, there, we didn't observe that infighting, but what we did experience was the insecurity of never knowing whether an individual Afghani that was being supportive of our effort the United States in collaborating with us, whether they were going to stay Northern Alliance or, you know, be recruited the next day by the Taliban to be an infiltrator, you know. So there, it was an entirely different experience of insecurity, never knowing if somebody is compromised, if somebody's gone over, you know, to the Taliban and they're just waiting to wreak havoc and.
Yeah, we had a similar experience on my first deployment in 07. We were helping to establish the Iraqi Civilian Watch, the ICW. And it was shady because we would invite, you know, the tryouts more or less for these guys to come to our FOB and, you know, try and see if they can do a push-up or a pull-up or, God forbid, a jumping jack, which was, you know, that was entertainment within itself. Those guys are, they're not coordinated. And, you know, come to find out, some of the guys we actually vetted and created this Iraqi Civilian Watch and later would be known as the Iraqi Police. You know, some of those guys ended up turning over to Al-Qaeda and fighting against us. And, you know, it didn't help that they came inside our FOB. You know, they looked inside our forward operating base, so that didn't help. But when we ripped out with our sister unit 2-3, we had told them that, you know, the area that we were in Fallujah was a damn hornet's nest. And we had hit them hard enough there in the beginning of our deployment that we really calmed things down when the winter months came. Because during the warm months, they love to fight. And the winter months, everything just kind of quietens down. And so when we ripped out with 2-3, their battalion commander, their XO, their sergeant major, and I think a corporal and maybe a few others had this meeting with all the sheikhs of the area. And a guy who was supposedly on the Iraqi police force that was protecting all the sheikhs in this meeting walked in there with the suicide vest and killed everybody except for the sergeant major, all the sheikhs, all the people inside there. And the only ones that survived was the old sergeant major and then the corporal because they kept their vest and their helmet on. You know, everybody else got relaxed, drinking chai and smoking hookahs. And, you know, it was so strange when we're back in Hawaii and we're hearing about that because they ended up losing 22 guys in the same area that we had only lost, I believe, one guy. And he was an attachment, so he wasn't really from our company. But, you know, the insecurity within your own security apparatus, I can understand where that can be very, very complicated. I never did clandestine operations. Obviously, I wasn't special forces. But I know whenever we would go out, you know, we'd have to set up, you know, our own LPOP. We'd have to set up our own internal security, perimeter security when we take over a house. But we didn't have to live like that for months. And I think, you know, the experience that your team and the other two teams went through, you know, it's really a one-in-a-lifetime experience. It's really not heard about very much. You know, I understand they made a movie about it, but it's really not spoken about because you had to rely upon, Steve, a different level of situational awareness, a different level of OPSEC. You know, you had to do things a very cowboyish way, but in such a what's a good word for that? Such a chaotic atmosphere. You never know who is around. You can't be found. You can't treat the wounded. If you get into a firefight, you expose yourself. I mean, I can see how that is constantly a stressor on you. How did you guys deal with that type of stress?
Oh, yeah, good question. In some aspects of going back in my memory, I really can't even connect with. So I kind of connect with some of the highlights, but I don't really, you know, it's hard for me to think about what did I feel on a day-to-day basis there. I simply remember that we would roll out in the morning. You know, we might roll out of the compound and do whatever objective it was for us to accomplish during that period of time, a day or two. And when we rolled back in, we did, it was with a very heightened sense of awareness that, okay, are we rolling back into a safe house, or are we rolling back into a compromised? Is our, you know, as we roll in, you know, do we see the signal that we've been compromised? You know, and I don't even remember all of that too well. I do remember that, you know, we had these tiered mud buildings, and then on one of the roofs we had a couple, like, even though we slept on just mats on the floor, there must have been like a metal bunk. And if the metal bunk was flipped upside down on this roof, it meant we were compromised, you know, so things like that, okay, are we compromised or aren't we? Is the sign there of compromise, or is it not? And even, you know, even still, so it was precarious, you know, even as you started asking the question, you were trying to think of a word, and precarious is what came to my mind. Our existence was daily and throughout the day precarious. And we were just exceedingly fortunate. Our team, we were extremely unusual. It is amazing that we were selected. I know why we were selected initially to be one of the three teams, because of the extremely strong leadership and fitness level of my teammates. I was a new guy on the team. Thankfully, I was fairly fit, but they were all exceptionally fit, as the scuba teams were notoriously the baddest teams. And so they were selected for that purpose. The team was, but we didn't, our captain had left. So we did not have a captain when 911 happened. And yet we didn't have a captain, and our warrant officer did not feel fit to go on the deployment physically. He was ready for, you know, he was about to retire, and he didn't feel physically capable. So the two highest ranking individuals didn't even exist. They gave us a captain while we were in isolation, and the team sergeant and my senior medic, Kevin Moorhead, and there's a Camp Moorhead named after him in Afghanistan, because he died in 03 in Iraq. But these two individuals, the team sergeant and the senior medic, two close buddies, were just the epitome of what a Green Beret is. And they were extremely capable and bright. And so they went to the sergeant major while we were in isolation, and they said, we don't feel good about the captain you've put on the team. And so they pulled him off the team, and our team sergeant became the captain, and this Kevin Moorhead, the senior medic, became the team sergeant. And so Steve, the newbie on the team, became the senior medic. And we did get to treat, you know, just as a matter of fact, we did get to treat after we'd been in country a month or so. It only took about a month or so to, quote unquote, overthrow the Taliban. So after that period of time, we had some opportunity to move about more freely. And we did get to treat some of the host nation, you know, people. And, you know, so it was a good experience for me as a newbie, you know, medic on the team, got to see some really good, or got some good medical training, thankfully, on the locals. Not really, none of our, you know, we didn't have any catastrophic injuries on that deployment, which was, again, given the extreme precariousness of our existence, it was just miraculous that we kind of left there unscathed. So God is amazing.
That's right. That's right. He's a good God to us. I got a question for you. Now that we've left Afghanistan, how do you feel about that, about the entire thing and the way we left?
In a lot of respects, I'm just very simplistic. I just kind of believe in the significance of serving your country, of, you know, doing your duty, following, you know, the command that is above you and doing your job. So I did my job, and I did it to do it for the honor of, you know, my family, our country. I'm not like you. I don't care much about politics. I don't pay much attention to it. I didn't get deep into the philosophy of why we're there. I was just a fifth group special forces operator, and I'm tasked to do this. So I did it. So never really got into it. Didn't really care that much about it. When I was deployed, I was focused on just doing my job. And when I got home, I was trying to make up for lost time and enjoy my family. And that was hard enough, just functioning that way. I didn't get into. So these days, to me, it's just kind of the reality of a fallen world that, okay, we can mean well, but we may make no difference whatsoever. But intention means a lot, because it means a lot to God. If you did it with the right intention, even though the outcome may have seemed somewhat meaningless, okay, it still mattered. And that's kind of how I look at it.
No, I think you said that eloquently. You know, I became very bitter after I left for many various different reasons. Obama didn't help the situation when I was in. And I guess, you know, I look back on my service and I'm proud, because when I served, I served. I didn't serve myself. And when I could help people, I was there for it, you know. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, we can be called upon as humans to be able to do that to each other. Unfortunately, Steve, I look at this fallen world that we live in, and let's progress in this conversation, and I see the now need for men like us with our abilities coming back in America, possibly being needed again, which for me, you know, I'm a bit of a, I guess you could say, a philosopher, a bit of a historian, and I want to know the politics, because I want to know the reason why I'm having these elite people telling me what to do and why we need to go there. And it's probably because people like Alex Jones and a few others red-pilled me. And when I found out there wasn't really any weapons of mass destruction, there wasn't really babies' heads getting smashed into the ground, why are we here? Why are my friends dying? Why did so many of us get hurt? And now I look into Ukraine, and I say to myself, we are going to get deployed to Ukraine. It's going to happen. Europe's going to lose control of this, and we're going to have to step in. Ukraine is going to have to need American boots on the ground, and I don't want that personally. But what I see is worse than getting deployed to Ukraine. I see the conflict coming here because of the politics. And one of the reasons why I study politics is because I want to make a difference politically, that maybe that is an oratory gift that I have, that I can at least help to explain to some people maybe why you shouldn't believe these people in the suits and ties so much, and listen to guys like yourself who, you know, you've been there, you've had this experience. Steve, I've come across a lot of guys who claim to be bad, bad dudes, you know, and MMA fighter and all these really crazy, courageous guys. And they've never been through it. They never really been through it. And when it comes to that conflict being here, they're going to turn like to guys like you for that needed gift of training on how to survive. So let's move into this conversation. You're a SEER instructor. Can you break down to people what a SEER instructor does? I know there's certain things you can't talk about, and let's not talk about them. But like, what is the basics of SEER?
Yeah, so the basics of SEER is, as it stands for, survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. So there are those phases of training. My time as a SEER instructor was predominantly in the resistance to exploitation, so the resistance phase, which I think is going to be extremely applicable here in the very near future. It's applicable all the time anyway, because in resistance, you're taught how to, number one, you know, how do you resist exploitation? How do you resist being a puppet, you know, or a pawn that is made beneficial to your captors or to the enemy? So you don't want to be exploited and be utilized to benefit the cause of your enemy, your captor. So we resist that. How can we resist it? Well, I think those skills are going to become very important, and they can be used all the time. I mean, if your boss calls you into his or her office and says, "Hey, I heard this happen. Tell me about it. Why did this happen? You know, or why have you been late to work?" And even in those opportunities, you can use your resistance techniques to not just blab, "Oh, I'm sorry, I failed, blah," you know, whatever. You can use resistance techniques to kind of be a little bit more thoughtful in whatever your response is, and maybe affect positively the outcome of that discussion. If you get pulled over by the police, if in the near future, you know, we're being challenged by having to explain to somebody why we're going a certain place or why our convictions are what they are, if you have training in resisting exploitation, you can slow things down so that you have time to think and formulate appropriate responses that are going to produce the best outcome for you. And I truly think that's going to become important. Survival and resisting oppression. So exploitation, or just resisting propaganda that's meant to oppress us and get us to respond in a way that we normally would never respond or react. And so as a SEER instructor, we prepare soldiers who are high risk. At least the SEER instructing I did was high risk of capture. So it was all U.S. personnel who were considered high risk. They had jobs and responsibilities that put them in environments that made them high risk for enemy capture, and we needed to prepare them so that they can avoid capture. And if in the unfortunate event that they are captured, how to resist exploitation, how to survive, resist exploitation, and return with honor, not having given up, you know, information or compromised their own integrity, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, for people to think that you could never be captured and tortured in this country would be very foolish. There are, in law enforcement, we have seen many, many different situations where that has occurred to U.S. citizens by U.S. citizens, especially with gangs. Reminds me, in Chicago a few years ago, I can't remember the entire situation, but several people had captured, several black people had actually captured a white guy who was mentally impaired. And this has nothing to do with race. That's who was there. And they tortured this young kid on Facebook Live. Horrifically tortured him. And I don't recall if the guy survived or not, but would your training help you to get out of that situation or to get through that situation if you were put in that type of environment?
It certainly should give an individual the best opportunity to successfully survive that type of scenario. There are, you know, when you think about whoever it is that is, you're in captivity, whoever your captors are, part of the training is to be situationally aware to identify who has me. You know, have your wits about yourself to comprehend, where am I, who has me, and what is their level of constraint. You know, are these individuals who care about nothing and care about nobody and have no organized structure, therefore, and they don't care what the world thinks of them, therefore, it means nothing how they treat their captor. They can just brutally torture you and kill you at will. That's an unconstrained captor. Or are they constrained? You know, do they have a chain, even in their organization, a chain of command? And maybe that command has said, hey, you know, and maybe they want to be, they're in some organization that just wants to get some notoriety and be, you know, want their voice heard. And therefore, you know, they're constrained, and you could probably, so the training equips an individual to deal with those different types of captors. And so, yes, the training should unquestionably facilitate survival, but survival is extremely, again, precarious, because it just depends, you know, is your captor, you know, did they have a really bad day and they just want to take it out on somebody, and they have, if they are constrained, they've lost their constraint, and so I'm just going to kill this guy and deal with whatever repercussions or no repercussions on me. So,
yeah, one of the things that it reminds me of in two different extremes, for one was ISIS and the way that they had their captors. Obviously, it was politically, religiously motivated. I'm fairly certain that everyone that was taken hostage by ISIS knew that they were probably going to die brutally, because that was their MO. And then the other part, and I'd like you to answer this part, is for people who are abducted, especially women. That seems to be the most common factor within an abduction, especially here in America. when they're abductors, typically, I mean, it's any time, day or night, children, women, sometimes even men. What is your best advice for that first few moments after being abducted? What would your best advice for someone being in that situation?
And so I do have to, I kind of, even as you're talking, I'm trying to recall in my brain what words are coming out of my mouth, because as you stated in the beginning of this discussion, this is not all information that can be freely communicated. It's in order to facilitate success for our service members, all the techniques cannot be, you know, communicated about.
And obviously, yeah.
So I have to be, you know, I want to be very thoughtful, and can, you know, communicate appropriately. But in regards to, initial response in a captive environment, again, you have to very quickly assess the threat level. What is the threat of death level? And you need to think of ways, if it is extremely high threat of death, you've already seen several people killed and now they're in your face, de-escalate. You need to try to come across as, I've got a family and I've got kids and they depend on me, you know, maybe try to, you know, humanize with them.
Because
they see you as an animal. They could care less about you. You're just trash. And you're just an object to help facilitate whatever their goal is. So you need, so humanize, try to get them to see you as a human being. I mean, this is applicable, in the world we live in today. So yeah, if you're accosted, as you already said, by some gang members, and you know, you might want to try to use some strategies that would appeal to their sense of, you know, decency, you know, or, it, you know, is there any structure of right and wrong or respect in their group, is there some religious thing? And so anyway, knowing your captor, if somehow you can kind of identify who has you and recall something about them that might help you to humanize with them, build a little rapport, you know, to save your life, then, but also just so de-escalating, so stay calm. They can be totally, you know, stay calm, try to calm them down, and, you know, and then on the other hand, if it's chaos and if it's chaos all around you, then we say, and it's kind of what I tended to be good at, is be the gray man. Don't stand out, you know, just, you know, don't be a loud mouth. Don't be all bowed up and just be the gray man, because that may buy you some time to make a real difference. It's not that you're not willing to step up and be involved, but stepping up in that case may just mean you take a round in the head and now you're of no value to anybody.
Right. So. Right. Dropping the bravado to extend the life of you and whoever else is with you. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. De-escalate.
So let's say as your experience as a SEER instructor, myself and Bob Griswold have started this conversation of how to get home during whatever situation. And I always like to use the electromagnetic pulse situation because it's the, I don't know, it's the funnest situation to think of in ways of just being absolutely crazy and out there. And it's probably one of the most highly survivable situations that would employ you to use basic common sense and survival skills. So I'm going to put Steve Reyes now on the spot. I'm going to put you 500 miles away from your home. Let's say the scientists were wrong. The car does completely die after the EMP pulse is hit. And you have 500 miles on your way home. The only thing you have is your go bag. In between you and your home is one large metropolitan city. Obviously, there's a time hack here. You need to get home expeditiously. But what's some of the first things you would do if you had to gather anything from your car and then start making your way home? What does Steve stop and first do for his planning? Sorry, I put you on the spot.
Good. Okay, good. Let's see. Good scenario there. So my car is completely worthless. And now it kind of depends on how prepared was I prior to that whole scenario. If I'm an individual who never expected anything to ever go wrong, and I have essentially nothing in my vehicle except some leftover napkins from McDonald's and some straws, I'm going to be up a creek trying to MacGyver out of straws and napkins. But nonetheless, I would stuff them in my pockets if that's all I had. And so advanced preparation, clearly in your scenario, hopefully you were an individual who was thoughtful and was prepared for an emergency situation. And so you had some emergency supplies in your vehicle. And so you would certainly want to retrieve those. You retrieve your little, you know, your go bag. Maybe it's got water in it. It's got some snacks, which I do. Thankfully, I do always tend to travel with a bunch of Lickies and Chewies, you know, snacks that I can stuff in my pocket. That is something I learned overseas and through the Special Forces training. Always have some charms, some candy in your pocket that you can pop in your mouth and give you a little energy. Yeah, just recover. Okay, I'm going to recover whatever I can from the vehicle that can help me survive. And then I have to really consider what route do I want to take. So many circumstances dictate the route that you might want to take. But it is a circumstance where you're going to want to blend in. You're going to want to kind of be a gray man, probably. You don't want to stand out. And then you also have to think, when do I want to travel? You know, should I just kind of roll under my vehicle and take a little nap and do my movement at sundown and, you know, in dusk and through the night, you know, really kind of, so movement matters. When are you going to move? What route are you going to take? And then once you do start moving, you look as you stay extremely situationally aware. You try to move. If it's precarious, if for whatever reason your movement stands out, then you need to try to move as covertly as possible. So, you know, going from cover to cover movement wise. But as you're moving, always being aware of, is there anything that I can recover in my movement that's going to help me in my journey? I may have had virtually nothing in my vehicle, but that doesn't mean I can't obtain items as I move. And so just kind of reconning, do a visual reconnaissance of your surroundings and think about, okay, what do I need? And maybe move in some of those directions to recover some of these, to obtain some of these items that you're going to need. So, I mean, a million different things, and it is a fun scenario. I mean, it would be great training to actually put yourself in that, in a micro scenario like that and actually experience it, which is what we do in our training. We do a lot of training where we're moving from point A to point B, and most of the time you have very little, because you're carrying on you, and most of our movement was alone. You know, in the training we were moving alone and trying to get to the objective to meet the standard, you know, to be successful. So,
yeah, you know, one of the things that I do this, I play this hazardous game all the time while I'm driving, especially when I'm going from one state to another. I always try to keep a map on me of every state that I'm in. Always keep a compass on me. You know, sometimes you got to relearn how to shoot an azimuth every now and then. And, I still keep my old Marine Corps infantry handbook, and I peruse through it every now and then. I start to remember just how much I forgot. But one of the first things I would do personally is, if my vehicle stopped, is I would immediately see, like you said, I would scavenge whatever I could from my vehicle. I would probably try to get to a high point of advantage so that I can see what's going around. If I'm on a giant highway, which is typically the highway, the interstate, that's how you're going to travel 99% of the time. And you're not going to take all the little dirt roads and you know, all that stuff that they see on the movies. You're probably going to be on foot for that. And not only that, but would you really travel down a no-name road that you don't know where it goes, when you know the most direct path where you need to go is the highway, is the interstate? I would probably stay, you know, as far away from the middle of that, that lane of travel, you know, probably in the wood line, but not so much to the extent that I'm crawling over barbed wire fences and over, you know, thorn bushes. I don't want my own travels to be restricted or, you know, come across something that could potentially be hazardous and hurt me. But I would scavenge anything as I started to walk. You know, if there's cars in front of me and nobody's in it, I'm going to look around and I'm not going to ask. I'm going to open doors. I'm not going to break windows unless it's an absolute necessity, because then that's going to call, and in my mind, that would cause way unneeded attention to come to me. I wouldn't wear very bright, flashy colors. I wouldn't wear anything tactical. That's one thing that, you know, I think a lot of guys in our industry have learned. You don't want to look like G.I. Joe walking down the street. You want to look like nobody. You don't want to be seen. You want, as you walk by a group of people as a gray man, you want to be forgotten. You know, that's the part about being the living ghost. You don't even want to be noticed. But traveling at night, that's something I've always considered, this duality. Do I travel at day when I can see everybody around me? I can see the conflict, hopefully see the ambush coming, or do I travel at night and I risk every footstep that I have? Because your auditory senses are going to pick up at night. So every twig that you break echoes for 100 yards. Every flashlight beam that you turn on, everybody gets to see, you know, what you just did, where you were at that point in time. I'm not worried about people with night vision. I'm not worried about people with thermals, because that's way out of my league already if I don't travel with that type of equipment, which I don't. I don't think anybody does. So in my mind, I would rather travel as fast as possible during the day and bed down somewhere secure at night. That's me. What would you do as you're traveling?
Well, even as you were talking, you know, you're talking, because you said in the beginning of the scenario it was a metropolitan, there was a metropolitan area between you. Well, we surely shouldn't have a tough time finding a bicycle.
Right.
You know, so depending on, and so much of this is dependent on the, what the, you know, real world scenario is. Is it chaos and people are rioting and killing and pillaging and, you know, or, you know, was it just an EMP and everyone is in shock?
That's what I think. That's a good point, Steve, because I don't think the immediacy is going to be, you know, killaging. I think that's a great combination of words. I don't think it's going to be an immediate riot. I think it'd be a shock thing. People would be walking around going, oh, my God, what just happened? My car doesn't work. You know what I'd be doing? God, neither does mine. I'd be stupid the entire time. There's one thing that I learned from an old gunnery sergeant of mine, and he said, in a big group of people, always be the dumbest person. That doesn't mean be an idiot, but don't let people know how brilliant or bright you are, because then everyone's going to turn to you for answers. And if you just want to get out of a situation and you don't want to be involved in that, then don't be a guy with any of the answers and solutions. Me personally, that'd be me. I don't want to talk to people. I'll gain the intelligence as I walk. Hey, what's over there? Hey, where are you coming from? Hey, were you listening to the radio? Did you hear anything? You know, does your cell phone work? That would be the little conversations I would have, but it would be very minimal.
I'd be the gray man. I'd be the gray man, and I'd be the middle of the pack. I wouldn't be the dumbest guy, because then you're expendable, and, you know, let's feed him the moron, you know, so... You know, it's like, let's see, oh, this guy's an idiot. So, you know, so I mean, that's what came to my mind is middle, you know, gray man is actually middle of the road. You don't stand out as the dumbest guy. They really just need to not know, you know, mm-hmm. Because you're not running your mouth. And you're really just observing. You're observing. And you're reacting. So, yeah, I mean, I totally get, I agree with what you said. I just, you know, I think it's an important point in this, you know, to the audience to realize, you know, there is a negative to being the dumb, you know, the dumbest guy. Mm-hmm. And that is, okay, well, you're the most expendable, you know?
Yeah. There's a way to gain intelligence and there's a way to just observe, right? I learned a lot of the ways to gain intelligence by dealing with criminals. And so watching their mannerisms, watching the phishing like questions that they would send out to get answers, where they would play very innocent or they would try to prey upon your feelings. And I saw it work 9 times out of 10, you know, against other officers. I saw it work. And so I sat there and I thought for the longest time, criminals have a very unique way of auditory communication. You know, they have a skilled criminal is a salesman. He knows how to sell his profession and get himself to weave in and out of trouble, right? Because they want to, you know, remain free and on the street. So they learn how to speak very well and they learn how to navigate people's emotions. And if you're confident with that, then I say employ it. But know when to pull the reins on it. Because there are times when I would be approachable and there would be times when I don't want you to approach me and I'm going to make it very visible not to approach me. I don't think you should walk around screaming tactical intelligence. I don't think you should be, you know, jogging to a cadence. I think you should just, you know, move with a purpose, use your skills and your advantages as they come along, because, and you can probably know this with your time, every mile could be a new environment, especially once you get into metropolitan. You know, would you want, if you moved into the major city now, let's say you couldn't go left or right, you had to go through it, you would obtain a bicycle if possible. Would you try to find a place to stay if, let's say, it's still relatively peaceful, or would you want to continue to push and get off the X and get out of the city?
Yeah, I think my strategy in life tends to be, you know, get off the X, speed is security, just be focused on the objective and get through that danger area. So yeah, I would be the individual who would take the risk to move through the night. And, you know, and even, you know, so that's kind of my response to that is, yeah, speed is security, move out, get through it. But stay very situationally aware, and you need to, and there is certainly something to, the presence that you give off. You need to give off an air of you. I don't want I confidence normally, you know, peace. You're at peace. You're confident.
Determination.
And you're determined, and you're optimistic, and you're going to get to your objective. And so for whatever reason I thought of this, I always tended to say it, you know, when I'm instructing and I'm teaching. And in particular, you know, if you're talking about resisting exploitation, which is where we were talking about earlier, and it's been kind of my job, you know, for the past number of years, I am a believer in the philosophy of stand firmly for something, or you will fall for anything. If you don't stand firm and you are not confident in what you believe in, then you're vulnerable. You know, you are easily going to be swayed, and you are going to be indecisive. You know, so believe in something, stand on it, and move out.
Here's one of the things I would like to ask you. Let's say you come across a roadblock. Let's use your skills now. And the only way, like, let's say you have to cross a water source, you have to cross over that bridge. The only way to get through it is to get through the roadblock, you know, and put Antifa, the Banditos, the Hells Angels, the Bloods, the Crips, it doesn't matter, a criminal unit that would be out there exploiting people, harassing people, probably robbing people. One of the things that I keep in my mind, and I keep in my person occasionally, I don't want to give away too much, but yeah, I keep things like this on me. Fake silver, all right? And you and I were talking about this, a little trade of the arts a while ago. Unless you know, and I'm not going to say how, unless you know how to view what's fake about this, I could keep several of these on me. And if need be, I could pass them away to somebody and like, hey, man, here's some silver. You know, let me get through. Hopefully, they wouldn't say, okay, well, now you got that. Let me see what else you have. You'll have to gauge that, right? But these are some of the things that I would keep on me if I was well prepared, ready for this type of situation. Would you say that there's any merit to having stuff like this?
Yeah, I think that it's really important to be prepared to barter. If you have that, you know, to wherever, part of preparation is just kind of knowing the population that you're in and what do they value. So if you can easily carry with you some things that you know would be decent barter material, then it strikes me as you may or you may not pull that Trump card out. You know, you get, at least you have it. It's a tool that you have in your toolkit that you can utilize if you feel like it's appropriate. So I think a lot of those tools that you can carry, you know, on your person, the kind of the more diverse, I mean, even if it's fake ID, you know, identification that, you know, I you know, when I have been in a foreign country on a number of occasions and in an environment where we had fairly free movement in that country, and yet there were a lot of checkpoints and roadblocks and that kind of thing, my favorite strategy was to just kind of do what I said. If, you know, if I'm in a vehicle and I come to a checkpoint, I get up to, you know, if there's a little line, whatever, I get up to that point, and I've actually, the strategy I've employed most is I act like I am impatient. I belong there. I've actually been requested to be there by whoever the ruling authority is, and I got places to go and I'm moving out. So you got your paperwork and you get to the guard and you just, hey, if you can speak some of the language, it helps. You know, I belong here. I am working for your organization and I got to go. And you just show it. You just, you know, show it, show them what you have and you just go. You make them stop you. You know, I mean, and you probably have a pretty good feel of whether they're actually going to stop you, you know, with lethal force, or they're going to just kind of chase you down. Well, you know, so that, I mean, that's actually been my favorite. You know, we've always been taught, you know, and it's not a seer technique or anything. It's just a technique of being in a foreign country, is you never hand them your documents. You show them to them. And if they act like they want to take them, then it's time. Okay, my time's up here. I'm moving on. You know, I got to go. I got important things to do. And most of the time, you know, they weren't going to chase you down. They got a line of vehicles behind you.
And you act with that confidence and determination, and it plays that mind game with people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's end this conversation on the getting home part. And let's say you're 100 miles from home. What do you start thinking? What do you start doing?
So out of 500 miles, right?
Oh yeah. Almost there.
It was 500 miles. And now I'm only 100 miles from home. I've made it through that metropolitan area, I guess. And I'm on the home stretch. You know, the first thing that comes to mind is stay sober minded, you know, stay on mission. You know, you don't start celebrating yet. You don't get distracted with, I think I made it. I think I made it. You stay focused. I got to finish this. I need to stay vigilant. I need to pay attention. I need to not get stupid in the home stretch, because I guess even in a lot of life, you know, people get stupid when they're almost done with whatever their objective was. You know, I mean, I guess they say, you know, how many accidents happen just, you know, a few miles from home. Mm-hmm. You did all this travel and then you screw up, you know, right at the end. So stay focused, and just finish whatever you employed to get you that to that point. You continue to employ that, and you don't celebrate until you are home, whatever home base is. You know, you're safe on home base.
Yeah, that's good advice. You know, don't celebrate too early. Keep your situational awareness. I guess it's more or less finish like you started, determined to get home.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're not home until you walk through the door. You know, you do some training now. You did some training with me at the Active Shooter Awareness and Reaction course back in September. You did part of the triage part of the medical course. What'd you think about that course, real quick? And then let's move on to your medical course that you're going to be teaching now.
Number one, I think the two courses are a great combination. So the the active shooter awareness course, which, you know, was of, I enjoyed it tremendously, you know, but then again, you did a lot of communicating. Thank the good Lord, you're a interesting communicator. So, because it was interesting. So I think that we're in a time where there's going to be it's a very obvious time where you have leaders and you have followers. We are in a point in history where there is a huge distinction between complacency and vigilance. And the majority of people are just kind of being followers and seemingly, you know, overly trusting, and as opposed to being very situationally aware, very vigilant, and wanting to be prepared for a number of different potential outcomes. So I think that we're at this very, very definitive time where if people will truly open up their eyes and look around, they should be able to see that these are potentially precarious times, and it would be wise to do some preparing, to think about being prepared for various potential situations. You know, preparedness is very often, well, what's available to me? There may be a lot of ways I'd like to be prepared, but those aren't available to me. So what is available? What can I do to be prepared? So even in our scenario, well, you can think, you know, number one, when you travel around, you can have items in your vehicle that kind of give you an edge if your vehicle breaks down or something, you know, unforeseen happens and you need to survive for a short period of time, or you need something that's going to help you, you know, continue your mission possibly without your vehicle, you know, or, you know, whatever the case. So I think I would encourage people to be very situationally aware, think about, whatever means of preparation that they can engage in, and as you're saying, training is part of it. So the training that I participated in with you enables somebody to be situationally aware and confident, prepared to have a degree of confidence. If there's chaos around, if there is trauma happening, it doesn't have to be a shooting incident. Shooting is one means of chaos and trauma, but it could be car accident. It could be a earthquake. It could be, a building collapsing, any kind of trauma. The skills that you talked about had a lot to do with just, you know, maintaining your wits about yourself and moving confidently and definitively. So I just think between the training that you are offering with your active shooter awareness, and if there's a shooting, and in most trauma scenarios, there's injured people, so then medicine and some tactical medicine is invaluable. And with both of our, with both of these areas, a little bit of training can go a very long way. A little bit of training can give an individual the confidence to make a significant difference in that environment. So, yeah.
Yeah. We had a SWAT team guy that was out there training with us, and you know, he after the whole thing was done with, he told me one of the best parts about the entire training was the medical. You know, when our active duty law enforcement does not get the type of training that we put on routinely, things become rusty. You do become complacent. Even I became complacent. It happens to everybody unless you're constantly training every single day, every single week. But the medical, that's the life or death one for me. I know a lot of people who've only shot a gun a couple times and then got into a shooting, and just through the basic fundamentals of marksmanship that they, you know, obviously went and trained on, survived the situation. But it's the medical part that kills people. The shock, trauma, the exasperated loss of blood. If you get, you know, your femoral artery or brachial artery lacerated or punctured, it's one of the reasons why I tell people the most simplest medical equipment that you could have on you: pressure bandage, hemostatic pressure bandage, and a tourniquet. That's what I suggest. What's the doc's profession? I know we only got a couple minutes left, but because we're going to have to do a round two of this. But what would your best advice be for something to carry on you every day for medical needs?
Yeah. Well, like you said, I think the same thing in regards to medicine that you said about weapons training. A little bit of training can make a tremendous difference. So it's really just, and I kind of like the see one, do one, teach one. So it can be that simple. And if it comes to hemorrhage control, and I'll hopefully remember to answer your question, but, hemorrhage control, to see somebody perform, the skills of controlling hemorrhage, when you've seen it and you've seen it up close, then you're kind of like, okay, I can do that. That looked pretty simple. I can do that. I can put, direct pressure on that wound if I'm not going to be afraid to, be in contact with blood, or I have, I'm able to put, gloves on, and so I don't need to be concerned about being in contact with the blood. Okay, boom, I can put pressure on that, and I can squeeze it hard to occlude the vessel and stop the bleeding. And then I can apply a pressure dressing. I can apply a tourniquet. Okay, so that'll save a life. That right there will save a life. You stop the thing that will end the life quicker than anything, and that is loss of blood. So I do think a little bit of training will go a long, long way. And the same thing applies to, maintaining an airway. You know, if somebody has a compromised airway, there are some very, definitive techniques that pretty much anybody could employ if you have the courage to do it, to give that person air, to enable them to exchange, air, move air in and out of their lungs. So what items would I consider most critical? Just like you said, something that will enable me to put pressure on a wound. So like a handkerchief, we call it a cravat. So a big handkerchief type thing that you can, if it's a square, you fold it into a triangle, or you fold, there's a number of ways you can use that. So I would carry what we call a cravat, which is really like a bandana, a big bandana. And that can be used for a pressure dressing. It can be used for a regular dressing, a pressure dressing. And actually it could be used as a tourniquet as well. So a cravat, otherwise known as a bandana, let's say, and a knife. I would, carry a knife with me for a million reasons. I'd rather have a knife on me than a gun. I can use a knife for a million things, only a gun for only a few things.
Right.
So carry a knife on me. The bandana serves as the pressure dressing, the tourniquet, and an occlusive dressing, which something plastic, something that I can use to put on a chest wound that will not let air pass through.
For the second chest wound, right?
Yeah, an occlusive dressing. You know, those are the things that, you know, come most to my mind, you know, immediately to my mind. And I've, you know, I'm looking forward to teaching the tactical, you know, the TCCC course, tactical combat casualty care, and doing that in conjunction, I hope, with your active shooter course would be great. And you mentioned Bob Griswold. I did talk to him. I think he said he was going to call you, possibly after I talked to him, but I even mentioned adding the SEER to it, a little bit of resistance training and situational awareness training. And it would, you know, that would just be a fun experience, fun and valuable.
Exactly. I mean, and you know, that may be one of the chances where you get the training, and then that might be the last chance you ever get the training, and then you have to employ it. You know, that's one of the reasons why we stress on training. You can have all the cool guy gear that you want. You can look super cool and still die from an infection. You know, I mean, you can look super cool and, you know, have your gun have a major malfunction in the chamber and not know what to do with the damn thing. And it just becomes a big stapler in your hands. You know, that's why we employ all the time. Train, train, train. If you don't get training from me, get training from somebody. You know, get training from your local area. I think what me and you do as a service to the people is we don't overcharge for training because we have knowledge, and we just, you know, by the grace of God, we went through the experiences we did. We just want to give the training to the people, because if people are trained and prepared, then that helps our country and that helps us. That's my mindset. If we can teach the people to at least rise to a certain level of expectation of survival, and if we're all on that certain level, some of us are a little bit higher, then more the better, because you can always learn more. You can continue your learning even when the apocalypse happens. You can continue to teach and continue to learn. And I think in January, we're going to try and have the course again. I know my class, at least, and hopefully in conjunction with yours. We talked about potentially doing a long patrol, you know, having a long walk, which would be kind of, you know, inclusive with not too many people, because you can very quickly lose control of that type of environment. But you know, we want to work on something like that, where we throw in a lot of the scenario based training, the medical training, the recon, the observation, the SEER training, and make that into a full experience that most people will never get in their lives and still be affordable. You know, and right. I look forward to us in working together on this type of project, because I think it's going to be fun. I know it's going to be fun. The last course we did was fun. Yeah. So, Steve, brother, I just want to thank you for sharing your story and for, you know, having the bravery to come on here and, you know, showing your face and, you know, telling people about your experience. And, you know, I hope you would want to come on here again, and let's continue down the path of, you know, putting ourselves in different scenarios and how we would make it home. Because if we don't talk about this, if we don't game plan this as we did in the military, people aren't going to know who to turn to or examples to turn to. So hopefully we can benefit people by giving them a little bit of a taste of what would we do in these environments. You got any closing thoughts?
Not anything more than what you just said, that, yeah, I look forward to our future collaborations, and I'd love to, you know, do another show with you. It's not my area of expertise, not my comfort zone, but I'd like to get more comfortable and a little more spontaneous in my capability of sharing the information that is somewhere inside of me, not always easily retrieved. So, but yeah, you know, when it comes to teaching and our future courses, for me, it's what goes around comes around. I like to receive valuable information. Therefore, I like to share valuable information. And then to do it in such a kind of casual, informal, and yet professional environment, you know, where, you know, in special operations, we called it big boy rules. You know, it wasn't party time. It wasn't stupid time. It was just meaningful and fun and, you know, serious training. And that's what I experienced with you in your active shooter course. And that's what I fully intend to provide in the medical training. And so, yes, I hope our class in January is a joint class, and I don't see why it shouldn't be. Let's just plan on doing it.
Yeah. Sounds good, man. Well, I'll be in contact with you, and hopefully we can start getting Doc back on at least once a week and every other week, try and take ourselves down this this radical path of the apocalypse talks, the get home talks. I find them fascinating.
Yeah, that'll be cool. It'd be good to keep my head in that game.
Absolutely.
So, sounds
absolutely
great. Thanks, Doug. I appreciate it.
Well, Doc, enjoy. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for coming on, ladies and gentlemen. Stay frosty, and we'll see you next time. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.